Public Radio. My name is Zephyr, and your name of the show today is Frank Prattle. I've got a couple amazing guests with me today. Renee De Guzman from Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, or YBCA, as I think they like to call them.
Yeah.
And Tony Rabat, artist, and also a high-ranking professor at SFA here in San Francisco. If you guys want to introduce yourselves, say a little bit about who you are.
Hey everyone, this is Renee De Guzman. I've been with the YBCA for quite a while, and it's great being here, actually, because I've been thinking a lot about sort of artistic strategies like this, and also artistic strategies like triple bass, you know, because I work for a fairly sort of mainstream institution, almost capital I, you know, a place that takes a lot of capital to run, takes a lot of infrastructure to run, and I've been thinking a lot about projects like this that sort of make institutions like ours almost obsolete, you know, the whole sort of dealing with geography, you know, the whole sort of ideological, fixed, white box kind of programming that most institutions are built on. But it's really interesting because we're encountering a lot of energy, I think a lot of positive energy, a lot of really interesting strategies that don't really need space, you know. For instance, this is more, I think, relevant in this day and age when the 21st century, the issues of public dialogue have to do more with media dialogue rather than geographic dialogue. And so also I had the opportunity to speak with Courtney Fink of Southern Exposure and talk to her a little bit about her transition from having this big kind of facility to being more sort of fluid and sort of non-physical. And while a lot of the projects are really difficult for her because she's doing a lot more sort of community work, a lot more sort of projects that don't, you know, that aren't as simple as sort of put a painting on the wall or a sculpture in a space and then, you know, come back, you know, months later, take it down, put another thing. But nonetheless, I think these are the sort of projects, these sort of temporary, transitional, transitory projects that really, really investigate public dialogue, you know, because I think it's really, you know, in the museum field, it's really become a very sort of kind of empty experience for a lot of new audiences. You know, they come for the spectacle of the museum experience rather than the experience of the art. So I think artists now, like Tony Rabat, are really best served when they try to probe different ways to engage the public rather than traditional models that create these kind of normative expectations. So that's why it's great to be here. It's great to be with Tony because I think his sort of practice of doing just about anything that he needs to do in order to make his work powerful and articulate is really kind of an important thing to support.
So Tony, tell us who you are a little bit.
I don't know who I am.
Brilliant.
I'm really happy to be here. And it smells really nice out there on the sidewalk. And I would like to be here today, even though, yes, I've spent half of my life at the Art Institute. I'd like to be here today as an artist.
Good.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So one of the questions that I have for you, Renee, and this ties into you as well, Tony, is I was reading your book, or the book, Beautiful Losers, the other
mm-hmm.
day, and you had spoken, you kind of led into that just a second ago, and you had said something in there that I really liked. You said that the museum or the large institution ran the risk of becoming like the ballet to the common people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That it didn't change mood. And you were talking specifically about street art at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe, you know, Tony and you could talk a little bit about that and some of the new approaches that you might be using.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, I think with Beautiful Loser, I think mainly people understood that as sort of a street graffiti show, which is important to support, you know, because graffiti, in my mind, is more fascinating than simply the amazing sort of visual styles that the people create in urban spaces. I think for me, symbolically, it has to do with, forgive me, Tony and anyone who's had a formal art education like myself. But it has to do with looking at different ways that culture is evolved. And often some of the most interesting things evolve outside of formal training or in spite of formal training. And I'm sure Tony can attest, some of the best artists that he's seen come out of the art school have been probably the biggest pains in the ass for He's nodding. So I think for me, that's what Beautiful Losers symbolize, this sort of opening up of different ways that culture evolves rather than sort of formal sort of channels of education or, you know, sort of the whole sort of arts ecology, galleries, etc. So that was kind of my thinking when I made that comment in the catalog about how there's this other kind of primordial stew that institutions have to be really open to. Otherwise, they're cutting themselves off from some of the real vital kind of energy, like we're experiencing now.
So, Tony, I mean, how does that relate to you being, you know, teaching new genres? I mean, new genres in and of itself, isn't that something that has come about because the old definitions of art got too stodgy?
It's difficult. It's kind of like, why would we have rock and roll schools?
Right.
So I think probably graffiti, performance, you were...
Now process.
It's unteachable. So yeah. It becomes kind of like difficult and interesting at the same time to place it within this sort of academic context. So in a serious way, sort of like teaching rock and roll, you know, you just don't do that. But I would hope that the institutions provide a sort of context for a dialogue about it, even within its limitations. You know, I am still, like, for example, at the Art Institute, you know, can we teach graffiti? Do we invite anyone? No. It's not. I mean, I miss the really best graffiti, which is the bathroom graffiti, you know.
Yes.
And the bathroom is a little too clean these days, you know. I don't read things about me anymore in the bathroom, so, you know, so I'm quite disappointed with the graffiti artists. Actually, they should go back to the bathroom. Forget the street.
You know, this is a question that goes for both of you. I mean, bathroom graffiti, especially because you know, it's private. Has been considered really the true vox populi, voice of the people. Mm-hmm. Do you ever written on bathroom walls? Tell the truth.
I miss it. I don't see it that often anymore.
Have you ever though?
Yeah, of course I have. Yeah. Call me for a good time.
I've never. I've been an avid fan of all the grout metaphors. You know, remember that trick, like all these.
Grout it out.
Anyways, but yeah, I think that is.
Is that because you were formally trained?
Yeah. I think that's actually a great metaphor. We were on KPFA yesterday, basically plugging the Underplayed show, this great artist-made music video show that Baron Galanu and Julio Morales curated, and also we were talking about Sensational. The show that just opened. This isn't a plug. It really is a legitimate reference. So we were on KPFA and we were talking about the shows and I thought that we were talking a lot about public space, you know, because I think that's the two things that tie the shows together. One is the urban space that these sort of untrained sign painters. Really enliven and also preserve self-expression and local interests in a public space when sort of public space is getting monopolized by corporate interests, you know. And so that was the what we're talking about a little bit, how, there's this question that Elita, the host, asked our guest from Mexico City, Juan Carlos Meña and Deborah, about did they think that there was more permission in Mexico City for this sort of thing to flourish, you know, the sort of do-it-yourself, by the hand, out of sort of the corporate control kind of thing. And in a way, she said, actually, it, you know, came out of necessity. But I think there's this kind of, and so she was kind of denying this sort of romance of having to sort of live in Mexico City because, you know, she knows firsthand how difficult it is and how a lot of this stuff comes out of necessity. But I started thinking about that, while that's true, I mean, I'm not going to, romanticize. I've been to Mexico City and other places, and a lot of this stuff comes out of, you know, this amazing creativity comes out of difficulty. But I think there is a big difference between public spaces in developing countries and sort of westernized, sort of corporate capitalized public spaces where, you know, public spaces are regulated here.
Right.
And the chaos and the difficulty that exists in Mexico City actually creates an open environment for these kinds of things to happen. And in terms of, you know, how do you occupy this stuff? You occupy it by being a little bit faster than the corporate interests, because corporate interests will always find a way to occupy space because they have the capital muscle to do it.
For example, I mean, Sony PlayStation, I think it is, with co-opting street culture with their new Game Boy ad, I think it is.
Yeah. No.
Tony, what's your opinion on that? The corporate world, like, shooting on.
I had one. I lived by Cesar Chavez, and I noticed one around 26 and Mission, and it was just painted over and tagged and everything within days. So that really kind of like satisfied me to see people, you know, sort of like reacting and recognizing and seeing through it. You know, where the ones on Market Street stayed longer. So I think it's also sort of the neighborhoods like watchdogs, you know. They know the language.
Yeah. I mean, there's strong symbolic acts like that, but also there's things like what happened recently with YouTube being bought out by Google, you know, YouTube being, you know, kind of the nap, sort of the new Napster issue. And we'll see how Google handles you know, this sort of appropriation of this open space that was actually very important for public dialogue, you know.
Yeah, I do have something to plug.
Yeah?
I don't think I had anything to plug. When you go ready, you have to have something to sell, you know? I mean, I had absolutely nothing to sell. I have a video class this semester, and speaking of that, and what I decided was to do the whole class on YouTube.
Awesome.
And I would like for you to go to youtube.com/NewGenerosTV, and you'll see all the work from your students up there.
That's very cool.
Now, a question about YouTube, though, is that I have a friend whose job working for YouTube is to go through and edit content.
Yeah.
Spicy, anything racy, it's their job to find it and delete it. So how does that, I mean, interact?
You know? Well, that's really great. The R doesn't get any hits on YouTube. But when the students, I mean, it's really interesting, and we have to allow the whole 15 weeks of the semester to see what the research, what we've come to think of it. But in terms of the infiltration into that context, some of the students are really sort of like wonderfully playing with it by putting certain words in the categories, like sex or blow or body, and then they get a lot of hits.
Right.
The ones that put R don't get any hits. So there you go.
That's a lot.
Another thing that I was interested in with the two of you is, Tony, you made a piece.
Yes.
A peace sign, actually, that was supposed to go in Golden Gate Park, I believe. You know?
Yeah.
You guys want to talk a little bit about what happened there for the radio film?
Such a process and journey, but the peace sign goes back to the 80s. The first time that I sort of did the peace sign, the big, large sculpture. And all I can say, and I'm not sure not to use too much time, is it's been a very interesting trajectory with that sort of symbol and object in terms of, in the 80s, I guess it was talked about in terms of appropriation and quite a bit of irony. And we moved to the 97 when the Golden Gate proposal happens. And I really was was now at this time had shifted to like very sincere about it, if I may say that. And it was a very sincere gesture that I sort of believed in. What led to the whole shutdown of the peace sign proposal for Golden Gate Park, I have to admit, made me kind of a little angry and frustrated and resentful about the silliness of the whole thing. And I have to say, when and Yabba Wanna sort of gave me the opportunity for the something like that, to perhaps vent some of that frustration. You know, there was, I have to admit it, a bit of a bitterness or a bad taste in my mouth at the outcome of all that. And it was really great to see it sit there for a couple of years until 9/11. And I immediately got a call to remove it. So now it looks like an old horse out to pasture over at Reina de Rosas. So it's out there if you want to see it.
I don't want to tell you.
Rene can tell you a little bit. I've been waiting for years to drop the little political bomb on the table.
well, I think that the whole history of this amazing public monument is like a political bomb to begin with.
That's right.
I think Tony quite rightly sort of proposed this monument in the Panhandle to sort of, the Panhandle is very near the Haight-Ashbury and the whole counterculture history of San Francisco is still alive today. That's kind of our roots, which I just saw a Gold Rush documentary. And but anyways, that's the spirit of San Francisco, people coming together to figure out something alternative. I think the peace sign was a great symbol of that. And the politics of it had to do with the dot-com boom. And the internet bubble, sort of created a lot of good things, but it also created this sort of thing in San Francisco that, I think we sort of escaped by the skin of our teeth, this sort of, transforming San Francisco into a place where very rich business people come to make money rather than come to make culture and other more supportable things. And so the politics of it was actually, while it was totally appropriate for the history of the neighborhood, that neighborhood was getting occupied by people without any interest in supporting that kind of reality. So I was very happy that Tony worked with us very hard to make it possible for our Barrier Now show, because I thought that was an important moment to articulate what San Francisco is really about during the dot-com boom when it was transforming in very upsetting ways.
Yep.
Absolutely. Like, this little space could have been Starbucks.
Starbucks.
I hate Starbucks.
Now we know that day to Mocha Mucha Mocha. That would have been a fucking Starbucks. Mission Starbucks.
Yeah, What do you think the role of? First of all, let's start out with this. Do you consider yourself a country boy or a city boy?
Beach boy.
I'm country. I'm as country as you get.
How do you think that conception of both of you not identifying with the city balances in your artwork or in your curation as well?
I think the art world is really interesting because it's this confederation of outsiders, that really have to, that come together because it's sort of like, the land of broken toys, this is all we have. and that's why we love, this environment. Like, the most amazing people accumulate around the art world. But I think it's really also important to understand at what point then do you become an insider and you're responsible for other things beyond yourself. And I think that's kind of, the conundrum of the art world, with, the massive growth of the market where art is now a lot like real estate, where the most affluent folks of the world start influencing what gets supported, what gets... So while it's wonderful and is occupied by very amazing people, I think we have to keep ourselves honest. You know what I mean? So
mine is a little bit more complicated. I'm not an immigrant or a political refugee, so I'm stuck here. And to be stuck in the United States San Francisco is probably the best place to be stuck in.
Yeah, it's not
that one. I'd rather be on the beach in Cuba.
Oh, really?
I like a lot, so I'm stuck here. You had the best of it. Of course.
Really?
Hmm. Absolutely. I never wanted to be here.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, because I'm actually applying for citizenship.
To Cuba.
I still...
I heard the beaches are great.
Well, I got here in 19... I have been here for, 40 years, since 1966, and I still have my green card.
Really?
Which is really rare, and I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
And I will never become a citizen.
Oh, come on, Tony.
Maybe for practical reasons.
I'm not trying to be...
Just practical reasons, because every time I travel, I need to get that visa, and it's a pain in the practical reasons. But it's really hurting. It's hurting. It's hurting, but I have to do it only for practical reasons.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm going through citizenship process now for those reasons, because I carry a Filipino passport.
But I've never been practical guy. That's why I drive big cars, and,
that's your beauty.
That's why I like Cadillacs.
And for those of you... Chicks like it.
Cubans like it.
But I think that's, I think this conversation, I think everyone can take a lot of different positions, but in terms of my position, in terms of wanting to become an American citizen, has to do with, the right to vote, whatever value that has in terms of altering American
Okay,
policy.
But I'd like to see the day where green card holders could vote.
Do you think that
No, but it would be an amazing difference to the whole landscape. Because I pay my taxes, I have my daughter, I live here, but I cannot vote. So now let's think about that. And we can, in the old days when I was in high school, we would even get drafted. And we'll go fight in Vietnam with only a green card.
Yeah.
So we could not vote. So I have a different kind of experience about this whole big, larger picture. And it would be a different landscape if I think green card holders should vote. Because we participate in the whole culture, we participate in the communities. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I can vote on issues of education that affect my own daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So that, it's interesting.
It's complex. It's complex.
You just came back from the Sevilla Biennial, no?
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about
tapas and wine. Tapas and wine. What was I doing? I was participating in the Sevilla Biennial, yes. I was doing a project, a project in which I recorded out of my window. I live in Cesar Chavez. 652 hours of the day laborers outside of my window. And there was a project, there's a three sort of projection video installation and a little bit of an interactive computer section part of it.
Was it
all surrounded? Pretty much surrounded, and then you could go into the computer that houses the 650 hours, which is 3 months, and that's the duration of the exhibition, and you could actually go to virtually sort of go through from January through March. And see that. It was the parking lot of the Calera paint store.
Yeah, sure, we all know about it.
And then, which kind of like an interesting, happy accident in terms of urban issues. It closed. And you can imagine 3 months of literally 9 to 5 observing the whole environment, and which sort of revealed itself. And not only just in terms of urban issues of sort of this sort of problem spaces, but the whole mineral environment as well as the pigeons, the whole ecosystem. I mean, it's just I'm building and building and building this whole project that I did here. Yeah.
How, you were speaking about computers, and Yerba Buena actually has an exhibit up right now where one of the main components, as we were talking about, is a computer and being able to add YouTube content and that as well. How important do you think computers are to modern art shows? I mean, you're in one that has to do the stuff on the wall right now. You both have shows with it. I mean, is just your standard art show dead if you don't have some sort of digital aspect to it?
Well, I think computers are important as a metaphor. I'm just thinking about the internet, as a metaphor for how different communities come together, artistic and otherwise. So, and how information is distributed rather than from a central location. you know, from an authority, a singular authority, it comes together like, you know, the Wikipedia sort of people contribute, and there's a consensus around truth, which is really probably the most accurate way of defining what in the end is real. You know, it's through sort of group consensus, communal conversation, rather than experts, etc. But I think, you know, while I'm really concerned about the obsolescence of physical space, I think there's still a real human need for people to get together for occasions, and that's why I enjoy very much the kinds of openings that we throw. You know, a lot of different interests come together around art, and there's a lot of sort of feeling that you can't generate other than, you know, sort of like interacting with someone who you think is smart, good-looking, interesting, etc., and then that sort of feeling and connection you build. You know, we're still animals, and we still live in physical proximity to one another. So I think there's still a need for sort of physical space. But how you program that space, that's a totally open question, you know? Do you have the traditional sort of ticket? Do you have traditional hours? For instance, we're doing this project with John Brummett, who's a dear committed artist, where
Neighborhood Public Radio.
Absolutely. And he's doing the Revenge Clinic, where actually, you know, I've tried to sit with him for as long as possible, because sometimes no one shows up. But it really has to do with that is better done elsewhere, and rather than the kind of space that kind of public use that we offer. But I think nonetheless, you know, public spaces and fixtures for people to come together are really important. You know, computers are good only to the extent that people use them well. I mean, they're not a panacea for anything.
Tell me what you think.
Context is everything, and I think if we're talking about computers in terms of how we use them in life, that's a different whole ballgame for me. I don't think I'm capable of talking about that. But within the sort of art context, I think let's go back full. What's going on the sidewalk? Something's going on the sidewalk.
Convention.
We have a demonstration at 2 p.m.
Yeah, but it's only cardboard. It's only cardboard. The real games.
That's a big.
So if I want to go back to that, I think, and if we go full circle, how you introduced me in terms of teaching and spending literally half of my life developing and being part of not only as a student but as a teacher in the new genres program, I think it's not so much a question of whether they belong or what they're doing in the art context, but ultimately is how we use them within that context. And you know, we have, you know, bad art and good art. I mean, it's just so, it's not so much anymore kind of the issue of the tools that we use, but what we do with them within that context. So there's still problems, and very, you know, sort of like incredible pieces that I've seen using them. You know, I think we just have to keep that sort of like yardstick to measure them. You know,
it reminds me a bit of the video fascination.
That's right. And so it's not so much, it's not so anything goes kind of thing. You know, we have to sort of have a reach with it. That coming back from Seville, as a matter of fact, it's interesting to notice how much sort of infiltration to what installation art and has become when we think of a moving image and video. And I have to admit, sometimes you do wonder if they don't just really belong on television. Mm-hmm. If these pieces don't belong in the computer itself, like why do I have to go to a place to watch something I can watch at home? So that's the only question that, you know, I think we have to keep asking.
Well, I think that's about all the time we have today. But thank you so much. It's 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr, and you're listening to Frank Prattle. My guests today have been Renee DeGuzman from YBCA and Tony Labatt, artist and also professor at SFA.
And they're the one that means good grass.
Good grass. The center of good grass.